You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Dina Eccles of Echo Valley Hope about her recent time at Standing Rock, what's coming next for the movement, and how to bring prayerful, peaceful activism home to your heart and to your community.
I do believe this. It will be held together by intention and prayer. Maybe you don't like the word prayer. That's okay, an intention. But it will be held together by a consciousness that we have not allowed to be part of our narrative. We can no longer allow the violence that we have been taught, the control by the might is right. That can no longer be the narrative that guides us. In other words, we can't fight back with the same tools that we have been held down. I just don't believe that will ever work. I think we need to respect one another. We need to learn to listen to one another. And then we need to be unrelenting in all efforts that we can make to bring back the garden that really is this earth. But loving words from your lips. She said everything changes with conviction like this. I need you to be good right now. I need you to be good, good, and how. I need you to be love right now. I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution.
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe Aguanu, welcome. I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawnland, where the weather is playing tricks on me. It was misty and warm and rainy yesterday. I thought that Maine had developed a new season, monsoon season. And today it's cold again. So the weather is always changing here in Bunawabskig territory. I'm coming to you from along the shores of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine. And I'm joined by my co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. Out here in Taos, New Mexico, it's been a pretty quiet, sort of mellow, overcast day. We're both writing, you and I, getting new chapters of our books underway, and for you, getting very close to the final stages, so we're all very excited about that. We'll have some more news about books and things in the works coming up mid-show. But I am excited to introduce our guest, Dina Eccles, from Echo Valley Farm and Echo Valley Hope out in Wisconsin. We've had her on the show a number of times because she's such an inspiring character out there in the world doing the good work and centering the heart on speaking truth with that centered heart. So she's just gotten back to Wisconsin from being at Standing Rock, and we're going to ask her a lot of questions about what she experienced, what she witnessed, and what comes next. Dina, thank you for taking the time today to join us on Love and Revolution Radio.
Oh, it's always a great, great time to be with you, too. So thank you for inviting me.
Dina, I am happy to be able to have this conversation with you today. It's been an eventful week. We were in communication earlier in the week while I was trying to get some friends out of jail in North Dakota who had been arrested at Standing Rock and trying to coordinate more supplies for members of our community who are still there and who are getting ready to head back and working to get them home safely. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience in the last few days that you were there?
Yes, I had gone back to Standing Rock and to Achetti earlier in the week. I was there for the last 10 days before the closing of the camps on the 22nd and 23rd that had occurred. And a lot of cleanup. A lot of people making their decisions about leaving the camp or staying and being arrested on the grounds of treaty rights, still all with the same focus of protecting the water. A lot of the bulldozers that waste management had brought in to clean up the camp and take down tents and teepees and things that weren't being used had bulldozed right over a lot of materials. So a lot of things were shredded and dug into the earth. Pieces of styrofoam and pieces of glass, plastic, things that wouldn't have been there had people been given the proper amount of time to do the cleaning that I know they wanted to do. So a lot of the time I would just have a bag and go around and kind of go behind where those vehicles had been and picking up that kind of debris. And always with that understanding of prayer and looking for best outcome, whatever that would be. And none of us knew really what would be coming next. There was a representative from the Army Corps who was there the whole time to work with the people on the ground in the camps to see how they could do, you know, what was the best resolution for things, and they were trying to come to decisions. And every morning there would be meetings with those people among them, and there was also someone from the governor's office. And I found those people, when I've gotten to talk to them, you know, they were very well-intentioned. However, they were also following the rules and the edicts of authorities, you know, higher than themselves. So I could see that they were caught in that. And then again, as I said, people were making the decisions, where would they go? You know, are they going to take the stand? Should they leave? So a lot of things were getting worked out, a lot of processes. There were people who were providing funds for those who had been in camp for a long time, needed gas money out or a place to stay. It was a tremendous amount of fear, but that kept being offset by the prayers and by the remembrance of the intention of why we had all come together. There was a lot of celebration, even, of what had taken place, of the thousands of people who had come, including the veterans, the clergy. So there was a lot. It was a quite a mixed bag of humanity. And, of course, constantly the surveillances of the airplanes and the helicopters, and also the knowing, as I was staying, my tent that I had been there, my winter tent, had been removed when I got there. Probably a good thing, because I probably couldn't have stayed. It would have been underwater just from the ice and melt of the snow. So I was staying at a hotel nearby, and as I would travel back and forth, we could see that a lot more officers of various kinds were coming, whether they were Fish and Wildlife or the BIA. There were many, many coming in. And we could see that they were carrying their rifle packs and things like that. So it caused a lot of, I think, confusion and fear. But again, the thing that strikes me the most was how the people continued to stay resilient, and they tried very deeply to hold on to their humanity through all of it.
So Ocheti Camp has been closed. Is there anyone who remains at this point? And what about the other camps? Are they still up and running, or what is the status of those?
Mm-hmm. So the official eviction date given by the governor was the 22nd at 2 o'clock, and that became well known on Facebook. And while we were there, shortly before 2 o'clock, a large group of people held prayer at the fire for the last time. And then they came together and sang in prayer, walking down Highway 1806. It was really amazing and beautiful to watch and be part of, walk with them, and feel the sweetness of the strength of them, and also the sadness. Many of them were leaving their homes, you know, places they'd lived for 7-8 months. So the deadline was then moved from 2 to 4, where the camp would be officially evicted, which meant that military police would come into the camp and physically remove anybody and arrest anybody who was staying. They also let us know that anyone who stayed on the land at that point, because it was being deemed a federal land, would be subject to federal law. So that would come with potentially increasing sentences and possibly harsher sentences. So then that became the next fear of 4 o'clock and what would happen. I had the opportunity to go back to the North Gate, which would have been the entrance. It was the barrier line between where the line of police were, and I might add the Main Street media were sort of sequestered back with the police behind that line. And after the people left, after the primarily women and children and disabled left, they erected a concertina. The people who had decided to stay erected concertina wire, and they use signs that indicated that this was treaty land and that they were going to remain in the camp. It was a very valiant stance. So, of course, those of us who were asked to leave and continued to leave with media and otherwise did so, but had contact with people, with journalists, independent journalists, who, by the way, were not allowed to be with the mainstream media at this point. And they were mostly up on 1806, thinking that Highway 1806, thinking that that might be a free and safe area from arrest. But what in fact happened was the police came down the road and began to arrest people who were on the road and did not intend and did not go into the camp. So most of the people who were arrested that day were actually media. They were also legal observers, ACLU, and others who were up on the road thinking that they were there to observe and be witness to what was about to take place. They didn't know they were going to be right in the middle of it. So at 4 o'clock, it seemed that the police and all of the various law enforcement agencies that were there, and there were many, including the National Guard, state troopers, including from the state of Wisconsin, backed off and stopped. This led to a lot of mixed feelings. There were great concern because we realized that any media left in the camps would have very little battery power to continue to record whatever was going to happen in the next morning. So there was some concern about that. So that was the first day.
Well, I think it's so telling, this whole process, as I've watched it unfold over the months and months that it's been going on, that the media hasn't really done a great job of reporting on it. When they have reported on it, their reports have been inaccurate, sensationalized, and mostly intent on making the people that were standing there to protect the water look bad. And yet, the first thing that the police do is they arrest those who are there to observe from the ACLU and the media who's there to report on a public road. They're not on any of these lands that are in dispute, but they're on a public road. And so you have this situation going on in North Dakota that a lot of people don't know the details of. A lot of people aren't privy to the information regarding treaty law. They don't understand what the U.S. obligation is to adhere to treaty law. They don't understand all of the jurisdictional issues between tribal land, state land, and federal land, which are a bit confusing. And so there's all of this misinformation that's being spread. And it seems like one of the things that North Dakota has been intent on is the proliferation of that misinformation, that they don't want anybody witnessing what they're doing there. They don't want people reporting on the way that they've behaved there. The police officers have their name badges, either or their name tags from their badges, either completely taken off or covered up. So they're seeking to operate under this cloak of darkness to do the bidding of this private corporation. You have public police forces, U.S. National Guard, all there in order to support what amounts to corporate terrorism, the forced removal of indigenous peoples from their lands, native peoples being forced at gunpoint to accept an environmental risk that the non-native people, the white people of Bismarck, were able to say, no, this is too dangerous for our community, but we are going to force you at gunpoint to have it go through your community. So still, after almost a year, the proliferation of misinformation and the manipulation of the information that's been available is still rampant. There are so many different things that I want to talk about in the next hour. But one of the things that I think it would be good for our listeners to know, based on your presence there, there have been times when I've contacted you there when I was getting reports from different people, because when I was there, I was at Sacred Stone Camp and you were at Oshete. What's going on where you are? Because there's, you know, this distance and there's even misinformation going back and forth between the camps. So how do people inform themselves in the best possible way to gain a clear understanding of what's going on there? Because, you know, there are still people there. They're still making a stand on LaDonna's property at Sacred Stone because she has that property deeded to her. It's still tribal land. The tribe does still have the ultimate say about what happens on that land just because of the way land ownership works in tribal communities, which is a little bit different than how it works in other places. So there are still people there. There's a lot of veterans that are still there. And how do you suggest that people find out what's still happening there? What are the best news sources that you found that you've come to rely on in your time there at the camp?
Well, I worked for the Oshete media, and that was a very reliable source. And I knew and I still know the people who were reporting for that. But that may have come to an end. I've been noticing Indigenous Life Movement has been having some good videos. Indigenous Environmental Network is still putting out some really good things. Digital Smoke Signals came out with something really clear and beautiful this morning, which included what you're talking about with the continued stand at Sacred Stone Camp. Sacred Stone Camp transitioned into an ecological village. So a lot of the things that they're doing there is to try to show people how to live in community in simpler ways so that we don't have to be part of the oil and fossil fuel industry. So I'll be very curious, and not curious isn't really the word, I'm really hoping that the same kinds of destructive tactics that were used by the bulldozers who came through once they had arrested the last of the people who were in Ochedi, and then again in Rosebud the very next day, if that's going to continue into Sacred Stone. I think it's definitely a possibility and something people should consider to continue to call the governor of North Dakota, to continue to call the Army Corps and anyone and ask and demand that a little bit of humanity and kindness be exercised in this. They don't need to completely wipe everything out. And I think that is a concern that people have. But yeah, as you said, people are staying there. And more importantly, I think I have given up and have for quite a while not listened to mainstream media. I mean, even Reuters was putting out dated material on those days. I was watching it, you know, and I was trying to see who would cover it. And even CNN, I saw the anchor from CNN who was trying and to get really good interviews, but when it came to them, CNN actually posting anything, it was all dated material. It had nothing to do with the reality and the anguish that was being caused by militarized police and what they were actually doing and the feeling behind it. I think people just have to pay attention. They have to acknowledge the reality that we cannot any longer, I don't want to say trust the media, but we need to demand of the media that they begin to act on our behalf and not just the behalf of an oil company or a government that has really gone astray. I think it's really true that a lot of the laws and things that are trying to be forced through in North Dakota are very much against the citizens of the United States of America. And they happen to be Native American. But what is happening there can happen anywhere. The good news is that some of the legislation is not being passed, and some of the almost 700, maybe more now, water protectors who've been arrested, some of those cases are being dropped because of inadequate evidence. So I think there's a lot we can take heart in, and should, really. But I think we also need to be really clear about what is transpiring there still.
I'm glad you brought up that very important point, Dina, that what is happening there can happen anywhere in the U.S. to anyone. And I think that's something that people should take very seriously and to understand that what is going on at Standing Rock is an affront to the values, the ideals that Americans have held for quite some time and not generally lived up to, but that is no excuse for letting go of those worthy values and ideas. The freedom of the press has been a very old, historic right of the citizenry that we have held, and that is being violated, and we're seeing a blatant attack on the media from multiple sides. And now, like you, I don't think the mainstream media is of sterling quality at the moment, but I do think that their rights need to be protected because these are the same rights that the independent and the alternative journalists require as well to do the work of telling the truth. I'm wondering what you see as coming next, or what the movement is saying is coming next as a next step. I've heard it said that this is, you know, the closing of one camp or the closing of one front and the opening of a new wave of resistance. What does that look like and what might that entail? And how does that relate to the fact that the energy transfer partners continue to drill all through this illegally and is expecting to complete their pipeline and have it operable by March 10th?
I have heard in the last 24 hours that I believe it's now 34 tribes who've come together with an injunction to once again try to stop the oil from flowing through the pipe. They may get the pipe in, and it looks like they have drilled under the lake, but having the oil flow is still a possibility to be stopped. But most importantly, I think that that drive, the thing that led, that brought me back and back again and again to the stand at Standing Rock, were the prayers of the people, the integrity of the people willing to stand in their humanity and recognize and not demonize. I mean, the prayers there always included the people on the opposite, quote-unquote, side of the river who were there with their militarized weaponry and their masks and all of that. The prayers that went out to those people for a change of heart, I think that that is so important. And if this quote-unquote movement is going to continue, it will have to continue in that vein. And for that reason, I really appreciate the strength of those people, of the Native people, who held on to, against tremendous odds, their understanding of their own humanity, of all of humanity. When they would talk about the prophecy of the four nations, the four colors, if you will, coming together at this time for Mother Earth, this is a really deep understanding. And I can't say that it's shared by every single person, but I can say that those who carried it and those who came from around the world to honor it and also share their own, a lot of the indigenous people and others who came from around the world while I was there, shared that same feeling. And to me, that's going to be the thing that's going to stop it all. The change of heart. I was in a court case. I went to see one of the people on a sentencing. It was the end of his case being heard and in a sentencing that he was going to be delivered. And I remember just sitting in the room, and I could see all of the people from the water protectors who had come there. I could see that they were in prayer. You could feel it. You could feel the love and the concern for their friend. And it came across that it was still not the best conclusion, but it was a better one. And I think we keep all working towards that. You know, let us keep letting this turn towards our humanity for everyone. Because it's not going to just be the water for the Standing Rock that will be polluted if that pipeline, not even if, when that pipeline unfortunately breaks or becomes ruptured in some way, which is highly probable, it will influence the water of many, many people. You know, they're saying millions of people downstream. And every day now, there's a new, we keep seeing it, a new pipeline rupture, a gas rupture, you know, something is happening, and we're allowing this to happen. And I think that the prayer will have to continue, and I think it will also have to become more local. I think all of us need to look, as I do, you know, within 100 miles of me is the sand fracking, you know, the sand mining. They're mining the hills, the beautiful, beautiful hills of Wisconsin, to take the sand and bring it to fracking plants and places where they're fracking in Pennsylvania and others. And we have to look at this, and we have to stand. And it's often on indigenous lands. It's often happening in reservations or places like West Virginia. I mean, I thought about it this morning. The fact that there are mountains that are still coming down in West Virginia, this is because we haven't taken this seriously. We haven't taken our ability to stop this seriously. And I think we can, and I think it's time. And I think that that is going to be the outcome of Standing Rock.
You know, as a Native woman who has worked for the majority of my life, certainly since I was a young adult woman, on issues of environmental protection, sacred sites protection, indigenous land and water rights, having witnessed also as a child the activities and the experiences of my family members, my elders, from my community standing up for the rights of indigenous people. Native peoples in this country have a long history of addressing these types of attacks. We have a long history and a lot of practice at standing in the midst of the storm and being able to continue to maintain our focus. Ever since the relationship with the newcomers to this land first began, Native people have been speaking out on behalf of the earth. That's centuries. You know, that's not decades. And the difference today is that people are standing with us and looking favorably on what we're doing. The difference is that now people are witnessing what we're doing in a way that they never have before, because they've had their own awakening. they've had their own reconciling with the violent history of their past and been able to come to a place to look beyond all of the stereotypes and all of the dehumanization that has been done to Indigenous people here, and to start seeing the humanity and the beauty in that simple way of life, what we call here Skijinawe Bamausawagan, and are coming toward that. It's Crazy Horse's prophecy come to life. And we have similar prophecies here. One of those prophecies is what inspired the ceremony that we're going to be having here in the East this summer for healing. There's a Hopi Rainbow Warrior prophecy, the Anishinaabe Eighth Fire prophecy. And so we're living now in a time of prophecy. In fact, the last chapter of my book, what I'm working on right now, is about living in a time of prophecy and looking at how all of the uprisings that are occurring around the world really are about people recognizing that it is imperative for us to stand for life, that life is in danger. Human life is in danger on this planet, and that we have a responsibility to stand and to protect that life. But there's also an urgency that's being added to it, because people are waking up on a broad scale, and they're understanding that nobody else is going to come along and do it. You know, there is not going to be some big savior that's going to come along and do it. Aliens are not going to drop down from the sky and save us. That we are the ones that have to show up. We're the ones who have to bring ourselves and everything that we have to this. And we have to be willing to put our body in the way of the destruction that's coming toward us in order to stop it, to slow it down, to continuously cost them money, to make it so that it is no longer profitable for them to continue. We have to show up everywhere that they're doing business, and we have to disrupt what they're doing in order to be able to continue to save life. And so, you know, I think that Standing Rock is just the beginning of this movement. It has just been kind of a clarion call for people to wake up and to recognize that Felix Cohen was maybe prophetic when he said that the Indian is the miner's canary, and that everything that's happened to Indian people is now starting to happen to everybody. Constitutional rights being violated, treaty rights being violated, laws being pushed aside. Conquest doesn't know any loyalty. It just keeps rolling along from one group to another. And so it's been steamrolling over Native peoples in this land for hundreds of years. And now it's starting to steamroll on members of its own society. And so, you know, we have a lot of work to do, but I'm also incredibly hopeful by what I've seen. And it's been the first time in my life, in years, decades of doing this work, when I have seen such an uprising of allies, which reduces me to tears every time I think about it. We have an incredible ally network here for the work that we do in the Northeast as well. And to see the difference that's occurred in regard to the amount of allies that are showing up to stand beside us and speak for the earth is incredibly heartening. And I don't think that there's an ending. I think that a Standing Rock was the opening of a gateway to something much bigger that's going to be coming.
I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you on that.
And so what are your next steps going to be, Dina?
Well, I'm going to continue on here too at Echo Valley. You know, the idea of living in community, living by consensus, you know, becoming self-sustaining in terms of energy, which we're very, very close to being 100%. And then that way being a model for people, what people are always welcome to come and learn and participate in what we're doing. And I think that's really important that we realize that it's not just here, it's happening many, many places. And that we all need to, maybe we can't be activists, we don't feel that inclination, we don't feel good about that, and that's okay, I understand that. But there's still other ways that we can divest from the systems that are harming the earth and harming the people of the earth. And it could be as simple as you stop using plastic bags, you stop using plastic straws, you stop using anything that's oil-based, as we're doing here. In fact, one of the people here at the farm has decided to encourage people to stop using clothes that have oil-based synthetics in them, which I thought was like, wow, people aren't even thinking about that.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence.
When God stood before you with her hands on her hips, she said, I'll accept none but loving words from your lips. She said, everything changes with conviction like this. I need you to be good right now. I need you to be good.
On this week's Nonviolence Minute, we're going to share some exciting nonviolence and book-related news. As you listeners know, Sherry Mitchell and I are both writers. But today, I wanted to share a little bit about my newest novel, The Way Between, which is celebrating its official launch this week on March 1st, and is now available on online bookstores, my website, www.riverasun, and can be ordered through your favorite local bookstore. Many of you listeners are already familiar with another of my novels, The Dandelion Insurrection, which features a nonviolent movement in a slightly fictionalized United States. Like The Dandelion Insurrection, The Way Between also features nonviolence in the context of a fictional story, but this time it takes the adventure and action of working for change into a realm of its own. Literally. This story for all ages of readers brings the art of waging peace and active nonviolence into a literary territory that is usually dominated by sword swingers and armed warriors. In this blend of action, adventure, and fantasy, young Ariara is growing up in a world of myths and secrets, war cultures, and missing heirs to royal thrones. But when she's chosen to follow the ancient and mysterious path of the Way Between, she soon learns that she needs to study as if her life depends on it, and the lives of everyone she loves. For war is on the verge of breaking out, and if she can't find the third way between fight and flight, catastrophe will unfold. Here's a brief excerpt from the novel. This was the challenge and the beauty of the Way Between. It wove through the world, right under everyone's short-sighted eyes, as commonplace as their own noses. The Way Between threaded through the wings of the birds and the winds of the mountains. It slipped between the tumbling water and the smooth stones of the river. It unfurled in the green young leaves budding on the trees, and it withered in the frost lines of autumn. While some roared into battle and others ran for cover, the followers of the Way Between stood their ground, neither causing harm nor allowing harm to be done. Neither fight nor flight, but a third option, a Way Between that brought the momentum of violence to the ground. If you're anything like me, listeners, you grew up reading great books and imagining yourself swinging swords and chasing orcs. But the thing is, when we grow up, those aren't the skills that serve us in the modern world. Our guest this week, Dina Eccles, speaks about the role of practicing tangible peace skills in the midst of conflicts. But many of us have had little or no exposure to those skills and practices. We've been steeped in the culture of war and violence. We learn it from television, the news, in colleges and universities, in common sayings, even from our parents and friends. And we've also learned it from the books we loved to read as children over and over again. The stories we tell are powerful. They shape our view of the world. They frame our scope of imagination and our knowledge of possibilities. They can lead us into conflict and hand us either the tools of nonviolence or the weapons of violence. It's time to change our literature to offer some of the most effective tools of change that we know, the skills and practices of peace, conflict resolution, and active nonviolence. The Way Between is my method of changing the story of our times with a story for our times. Reader by reader, heart by heart, mind by mind, I hope this book will transform us into the heroes and cheeros our world is longing to find. And now let's return to our program.
This divestment program, some people, I don't have money, maybe, to pull out of a bank. But I still can vote with my dollars. I can still say, And it feels good. It feels really, really good to be life-affirming and earth-supporting. It feels really good. So that's going to continue, and I'm happy for that because it's how I ground myself. It's how I can speak very forcefully because I'm living it and have been living it. And I will continue in any way that I can to message what I've seen and learned from the people at Standing Rock and also other possibilities of where I can go and be a part of something that's happening and also try to continue to develop more community right here where I live. And I don't mean by that just at Echo Valley, but in the surrounding areas as well. Because we have learned to be isolated. This is another thing that was really powerful about Standing Rock, was that everyone was welcomed as a human being. Whatever prayers you had were welcomed. You didn't have to just speak Lakota or sing Lakota. If you had a different prayer, say your prayer and say it pridefully in a true way, in a humble pride. And that was very powerful, to be embraced as a human being and not put in that isolation. And I think many of us are going to be healing from that isolation and need to. And so we need to greet each other as human beings, and we need to help each other understand this. For that reason, I don't take partisan sides on issues. I just don't find it to be useful. I think we're wasting a lot of time in bickering over politics. That's not to say that we can't be mindful and watchful and make sure that things aren't happening to us, but I think it's a question of how we proceed. So we treat each other like human beings, demand to be recognized as human beings, and protect the earth. That's what I'm going to be doing.
That sounds like a pretty good recipe there, Dina. I think a lot of people can jot that down and maybe apply it where they live. I like that you brought in the divestment, because I know for many of us who couldn't go to Standing Rock, supporting the divestment movement and defunding DAPL with the 17 major banks that were funding it was a major part of how we could participate and support, as well as other means of solidarity actions. And that work continues. I mean, there's no reason to stop urging people to move their money out of these banks just because a camp closed. But rather, this is the time to keep moving that money, even if they do, despite all of our prayers and wishes and actions, manage to get oil flowing for a moment. We have to remember that this is man-made, and what man makes, man can unmake. And so if they get that oil flowing, that is not the end of the struggle. Someday we know if humanity is going to be here on this earth, oil is not going to be flowing through that pipeline or any of the pipelines. And so we need to have our eye on that and remember that and just keep working to take away the money from the people who want to use it for this work. And this is at a critical tipping point. I think many of us forget that, but the financial end of fossil fuels is very teetery right now. It seems so huge and massive, but it really is, and many very large economic and financial groups are talking about the problem of stranded assets that will remain in fossil fuels. And the time is now to push those to the point of getting everyone, our alma maters, if we are part of colleges or universities, our retirement funds, if we are people who are part of a retirement fund, our personal investments, if we are so fortunate to have such things in the world, or those of our friends and family, to get them out of fossil fuels right now. This is critically important work for everyone, for every pipeline, for every water source, for every watershed. And I think, you know, that goes into my personal list of what can we do now, what comes next, is that that work should be escalating right now, not dwindling. I'm curious, you know, you mentioned a few of these, but what if people are in their local area and they're looking at something like frac sand mining or a fracking operation or a factory that's spewing toxins into the air? What are some of the key things that you observed or learned from Standing Rock that you think might be helpful for people as organizing campaigns in their own area?
I think the things that I've seen be successful even here, by the way, success can't be measured in absolute outcome, nor can it be measured in time. These things are taking time. It has been finding like-minded people, which takes time. encouraging people to find their own personal empowerment and trusting that, whether it be someone who can stand up and speak up or write letters or in whatever way people can, to welcome that empowerment of the individual for the collective, for the community. I think that that's what's happening. I keep remembering a woman, the black woman in New York. I didn't catch her name. I don't remember her name during the Occupy movement. And she said, we're finding one another. And that keeps echoing in me, that we're finding one another. And I think that we need to keep finding one another and stand together in whatever way. It's hard to know from community to community, but I do believe this. It will be held together by intention and prayer. Maybe you don't like the word prayer. That's okay, then intention. But it will be held together by a consciousness that we have not allowed to be part of our narrative. And we have to allow that in. We can no longer allow the domineering aggression that we have been taught, the violence that we have been taught, the control by the might is right. That can no longer be the narrative that guides us. In other words, we can't fight back with the same tools that we have been held down. I just don't believe that that will ever work. I think we need to respect one another. We need to learn to listen to one another. And then we need to, you know, be unrelenting in all efforts that we can make to bring back the garden that really is this earth and to stop the destruction that we have allowed. I know many of us unwittingly have been part of this destruction. And it's time now to acknowledge that and change it. That's all. It's very simple. And as each one of us does it, it just grows and grows and grows. It's like drops into the river. And that's what's happening. That's what Standing Rock has really tipped the scales. The scales have been tipped. The welcome now is to each person, stand up. Stand up and be part of this change, this human, I like to call it humanity rising.
One of my favorite quotes that I use in my classes is that you're something the universe is doing in the same way that a wave is something that the ocean is doing. And when we think about our connection to the collective, that we oftentimes, as you said, we feel so set apart. We feel like we're not connected to one another and that we don't have the same power as these huge patriarchal systems that have been developed. And yet we don't recognize oftentimes that we're the ones that are supporting them. They're being kept alive on life support that we're actually providing the energy for. And so the way for us to be able to shift away from these really toxic and harmful practices is for us to take away that life support and allow them to die a natural death. If we're not supporting them, if we're divesting our lives in every way possible, like you're doing out at Echo Valley Farm, if we're really consciously working to establish new systems outside of those systems that model more closely what it is that we want to be promoting into the future. I write about four different areas that I think we really need to be focusing on. We need to be focusing on the protection of the water. People need to really be consciously aware of what's going on with the water. And I think that's one of the things that Standing Rock brought to light is that, you know, we have a finite amount of water on this planet. You talked about fracking. For the first time in human history, we're taking water out of the water table through hydrofracking. And we're contaminating at an incredibly rapid pace, the amount of clean water that we have. People all over the world are in a state of crisis on a daily basis, searching to find clean water, which is creating a lot of the refugee crises in other parts of the world where people are fleeing rural areas and heading into the cities in order to try to find water so that they can stay alive. And so we need to be really conscious of what's going on with our water, and we all need to be united around that central issue. We don't solve the water problem that we have. We're not going to be able to stay alive long enough to solve the other problems that we have. We also need to be thinking about food. I mean, one of the problems that we have is that we have these food production systems that are so disconnected from the places where we live our lives. We're no longer connected to these basic sources of our survival that are not resources. They're the sources of our survival. So if we can get reconnected with our waterways, if we can get reconnected with the growth of our food production, localize it, reduce the size of it, reduce the impacts of those two the food agricultural industry. Meat industry is extremely toxic. That's a whole other show. And then reclaiming our sovereignty over energy production, distribution, and consumption. There are a lot of places that are localizing their energy production. And there are some barriers to that, but they can be overcome. You know, being able to create small, localized energy cooperatives that meet the needs of your region, that don't have such a dramatic impact, but also that take away some of the powers of these huge conglomerates, allows us to take back some of the control over our lives. So we think we need to do this big, broad scale thing, but what we really need to do is we need to make everything smaller and localize it, and start working consciously and cooperatively and collectively in our local areas to take away the power that those industries have over us by disengaging from participation in them. And so there are so many different things that we could be doing right now to empower ourselves and to empower others. And I think that you have been a fine example of that in your life and the work that you do. What you guys are doing out at Echo Valley Farm is certainly a great example. And if folks have a chance to go out there and visit, I recommend that you do. It's a lovely little place. You'll be welcomed and you'll be fed well and taken good care of while you're there. But those are the types of things that we need to do, turning Sacred Stone Camp into an eco-village, really being consciously aware of what can we do when we feel so overwhelmed in the work that we're doing to try to reclaim some of our own power. What have you done in times when, because I know that you've been doing this work, what have you done in times when you felt the most despair to find your hope again and to find your sense of power again in the midst of the storm?
Well, I've been very fortunate because at a very young age, I came to the realization that there was something inside of me that can't be touched. And I have spent, with the help of some great guidance, I've spent the majority of my life really honing my skill of being able to rest in that place. And it's not a mindset. And so when I feel despair, or if I feel victimized, or if I feel something, fear, overwhelming anger, I go there. I stop it. I find my humanity again. And I think we all can do that. I think we all do that. But it requires a practice. You have to practice not just giving in to your emotions. Yes, acknowledging them, because they're telling you something. You know, I have every reason to feel anger as I see people coming with clubs towards my friends. I have every reason to feel those things. But if I act out of that anger, I'm going to lose something. If I act out of my despair, you know, it has a way of being very infectious. And then we all start feeling that despair. I think instead, to be able to find that place inside of us, which exists for all of us, that is peace. Because peace isn't it's not a thinking game. It's a feeling game. Find that place. Take the time that you need to root yourself there. Then respond from there. And again, that's why I say, call it prayer or intention. However we can ground ourselves in that, whatever way. And this is something we've not been able to do. We have vilified. The Puritans came, and Native people were not Christian, therefore they were less than. We have done this, and we do this over and over and over again. And now we're doing it to the Muslims. We've done it to the Jews. We do it to one another. We need to see that we share the same. We share the same loves. We share the same hopes. We're the same. And however we express our peace, our connection to that which is greater than us, that's okay. We need to accept that from one another. Whatever this is, this infection, this disease of humanity that has not allowed that, that is our enemy. Our enemy isn't the person who's spewing it. The enemy is the disease that we have allowed. So I just work really, really hard to catch it in myself. You know, if I found myself when I was there, if I found myself being angry by things that were happening to people, if I found myself feeling fearful, I would just do everything I could to come back to my center, to come back to myself, my true self. And then that's the place I try to speak from. That's the place I try to do everything from. Because anything less than that, I'm cheating my creator. I've been given a gift. We have all been given a gift. We are unique. And nobody can do what we can do. Nobody. But if we have not discovered what we can do, if we have not discovered our personal power, if we have not held firm to that, then there's nothing we can do. So really what's being asked is everybody stepping up now, I think. I think that's the key. And that's why I loved being there. I loved being there because it reaffirmed something that I knew, but that I don't always have access to. Being around so many people who have that in their conscience to live in the quality that we're capable of living in with one another. The kindnesses that were shared, I will never forget that. And I know that all of the people who came, whether it was for a day, an hour, a week, a month, nobody who was there will forget that. They won't forget that. It's seeds planted, and those seeds will germinate. Some may take a long time to grow. Some may grow quickly and bear fruit. But it's happening. Human beings are finally being given a chance to reclaim who they are. And that's what peace is.
What you mentioned, Dina, are the skills that I feel we've been able to postpone in times of increasing injustice. But in these times when we cannot increase the injustice anymore and sustain life on Earth, I feel like those very skills that you describe are the skills that we can no longer ignore, that we need to become fully embodied human beings, skillful beings, and sensitive beings, aware beings, and that we stand upon a great legacy of cross-cultural sharing of spiritual knowledge, of awareness knowledge, and that that is here to serve us in these times, and we're very fortunate for that. I also love that you say, do what you can do, that we are each unique beings, and that each of us is going to show up in a way that is completely unique for us. I can really see that in stories like Edward Snowden. Only Edward Snowden could do what Edward Snowden did. And yet we need everyone to consider, what is it that I can do? I've been reflecting on this as I get ready to re-release my first novel, Steam Drills, which is very much a story about that, about a coal company lawyer who decides he can no longer continue serving the end of humanity. But it's not just enough to walk away. He needs to do something to help repair the harm that he's done. And I feel like when we look at what we can do, one of the things we have at our fingertips is to examine our lives for those skillful means, for those very particular things that we are standing at the crossroads and the pivot points and the leverage angles to be able to make that change occur, that we each embody so many of those. Now, before we get to the end of the show, I did want to ask you about your new podcast and to also just let people know that you have a great blog called Let Kindness Win, which puts out these little bursts of these ideas that you're sharing here and is a wonderful place for people to go and peruse what's posted and stay following what you post from time to time. But tell us a little bit about this new podcast that you're working on and where people can connect with that.
It's called Humanity Rising at, I believe, Podomatic.com. And I only have so far two posted because I haven't had the time to really do much more with it. I'm not the best technologically, so I'm always looking for some help in that regard. But my hope is to be able to interview people like you and also just take those moments, like you refer to it as bursts, and I think they are. They're kind of like bursts of awakening and also of joy. There's a lot of joy. And Let Kindness Win, it's about, wow, you know, kindness is a really cool thing. And I just talk about that in little incidences that happen here on the farm with the animals, you know, different ways that I see it. And I've been really happy to see that people enjoy them, you know, their little snippets. I don't see myself becoming very professional or expert at any of these things, so please don't go there looking for that. And if you want to point out my typos, that's okay too, but I don't plan to be an expert in any of these things. I just plan on continuing my process of being a human being and speaking out at this time. And hopefully if it energizes people and if it gives them a sense of finding their own bursts of joy and kindness and love, then I say good. It served its purpose.
Well, Dina, I personally would like to offer you my gratitude because you not only talk eloquently about the place where we are, where we need to go, what's influencing us at this time from our history, but you also show up to do the real work. You showed up at Standing Rock time and time again to do the real work, being there during the harshest conditions, wandering around with garbage bag, picking up trash in the mud, in the cold, and, you know, doing what needed to be done. And that's what we need right now, is that we need people who are willing and able to show up and do what needs to be done. It doesn't matter what letters are behind your name. It doesn't matter who you're aligned with politically. What matters is that we're all showing up and doing what needs to be done to protect life. And so as we're ending the show today, Dina, is there any one thing that you would like to say to our listeners to sum up your reflections and also provide them with some inspiration for going forward?
Respect yourself. Respect others. Listen to yourself. In the quiet moments, listen to others. Never leave room for doubt. I think those are things that we all need to do now.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution. Love, love.
Thanks this week to our guest, Dina Eccles. And thanks to my co-host, Sherry Mitchell, for once again bringing up the key points that need to be brought up on the topics that we're discussing. Our theme song is Love and Revolution with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find her great music, including this song, at www.dianepatterson.org.
And I'd also like to thank my co-host, Rivera Sun. It's really inspiring for me to be able to do this show with somebody who I know not only is able to talk articulately and intelligently about these subjects, but who also is out there in the world working to create the change that we discuss. If you enjoyed this show, you might also enjoy some of the things that I post on my Facebook page, Sacred Instructions, which can be found on the Love and Revolution webpage and on the podcast. Love and Revolution Radio also has its own Facebook page now, and you can also find that, the link to that, on the webpage and on the podcast. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program that can be broadcast in your local area. All you have to do is call your local radio station and ask them to put it into rotation. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on Rivera Sun's website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. One of the reasons we enjoy speaking with Dina so much is that she really walks her talk, whether it's building out renewable energy for her local farm or building community on that local farm, or protesting at the state capitol where she is, or traveling all the way to Standing Rock to stand in solidarity and allyship with others. She really makes sure that every word she speaks is followed up by practice. So listeners, think about this. The one thing she says is most pivotal for her is kindness. So perhaps you can think about one way to let your kindness win. By the time we talk to you, next week.
What if you knew?